Living room conversations enable people to come together through their social networks as friends and their friends to engage in a self-guided conversation on an agreed-upon topic. Typically, the conversations have self-identified co-hosts who hold differing views, and they may or may not be from different ethnic groups, socioeconomic backgrounds, or political parties. You get the idea. Each host invites two of their friends to join the conversation, and participants follow an easy-to-use format that offers structure and a set of questions for getting acquainted with each other and each other's viewpoints. Conversations, we find, foster new relationships, and they often reveal surprising common ground. The vision for Living Room Conversations is a world in which people who have fundamental differences of opinion and backgrounds work together with respect and even joy to realize the vibrant future we all desire. Living Room Conversations are special because people agree to follow six simple ground rules. It's all stuff we learned in kindergarten, but here's a real quick reminder. Number one, be curious and open to learning. Number two, show respect and suspend judgment. Number three, look for common ground. Number four, be authentic and welcome that from others. Number five, be purposeful and to the point. And number six, own and guide the conversation. So basically, no soapboxing, listen well, and be authentic. And if you look for common ground, people often find it. Enjoy your very own Living Room Conversation.
Welcome, everyone. Today's radio show on Coffee Party Radio is a little bit behind the scenes look at Living Room Conversation.
First off, I'd like to say welcome to Loki King, our co-host and executive producer today.
Thanks, Debbie Lynn. I look forward to another awesome Living Room Conversation.
I have with me today two guests, Joan Blaze, who's the co-founder of Living Room Conversations, and another, you know, little organization called Move On. And also with us is Serena Witherspoon, who has co-hosted a Living Room Conversation. Serena did a really nice conversation on youth voting. And it's led to some other things with Living Room Conversations. So we're going to kind of explore that and look a little bit more behind the scenes. So welcome to the show today. Joan, I'm going to go ahead and start with you and do just a little bit of background work. You know, how did Living Room Conversations come to be with you?
Living Room Conversations are a reaction on my part to seeing partisan politics become increasingly dysfunctional and having a point where I was having good conversations with people with very different political viewpoints and finding out in the area of climate change in particular, where once a conversation was possible, that in fact the boundaries, the capacity to talk about climate became less available. And the realization that when we have a personal connection, we really can talk to each other, even about things that have become partisan flag, so to speak. And that's what Living Room Conversations are very intentionally structured, so that we can talk across differences. And we've been learning that it doesn't need to be partisan differences. It can be any kind of difference. And it's very fun exploring this area.
Thanks, Joan. And Serena, I'm going to bring you in. You're a student at Berkeley City College right now. And what kind of inspired you to want to co-host a Living Room Conversation about youth voting?
This year, when I moved back to Berkeley, I switched my major to sociology, and I got really involved in kind of like social justice projects. I started getting really interested in politics, but not really knowing where to get good political information, I guess, for myself and like my peers. But I did know Joan, and I know that she's very involved in politics, so I went to talk to her about what I could kind of do there, and we just decided that it would be interesting to host a Living Room Conversation about youth voting, which was just something that we were discussing on a walk one day.
You know, that's really awesome, and Joan, of course, is famous for her walks. So what happened for you in your Living Room Conversation? Can you kind of walk us through what happened?
Yeah, so I had a conversation with, I co-hosted with my brother. It was two of our friends each, and we just kind of talked about our opinions about youth voting, just like on the basis of like who was registered to vote why and why not, and then kind of just further than that, like what people kind of just thought about politics and their experience learning about politics, like growing up and in effect. And we found that we had a lot of similarities in what we thought about what was important, I guess, around the voting issue. But then we clearly like expressed that in really different ways, where some people thought that registering to vote and trying to stay aware when it comes to politics is the best way to kind of make change happen. And then the other side of the conversation felt that like it's kind of just a waste of time because there's no real like power in it for people, and they just don't feel like that kind of like power through voting. But through the end of the talk, like I guess the biggest thing that happened was that everyone, the end, really felt that voting, or felt the desire to register to vote. And then the twist was that a week later, when I talked back with the people who said that they wanted to register, they had gone back to their feeling of just not so much caring, I guess, about the whole registering to vote process. So learned a lot. There's a lot of changing, I guess, of opinions.
Well, what would you say is like the one big thing you learned in that conversation?
I think that the most significant thing was that during the conversation, when people were really passionate about it and like hearing about the whole, like talking with their peers about like the problems in the world and like what we could do to change them, everyone felt in the end that voting was just something that you could and should do. And then the process of like going back, I guess, to that kind of like apathy that a lot of, I think, youth feel. So I think that the most important thing that we learned was that like through keeping these kinds of conversations going, like constantly, that can inspire like a lot, I think, of change.
So how did like what you learned in school kind of impact or influence what you feel or felt about voting and education about the issues in general? What happened in school? Did you feel prepared?
That was like one of the big things that we talked about as well. Like we felt very like unprepared and kind of like scared by the thought of voting, just because we, like, I had taken a government class and I'd learned, you know, everyone learns government, like at Berkeley High, at least where I went and where the people went in my conversation. We take a government class where we learn like what government is and like how it works, but we don't really learn about what's going on like currently in politics and like what ballots are being like put on, you know, and that kind of thing. And I think that we all agreed that like in high school, especially in senior year, that would be like a great time for us to start learning about those kinds of things, just so that when we do turn 18 and we now have this responsibility, we are equipped to like use it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things a lot of people my age at least aren't aware of, is because I remember having both a social studies class and a civics class, and a current affairs class even for that matter, where we got to talk about all that stuff, but that's not necessarily how it is today.
We didn't talk about anything. I think it's sometimes different in like presidential election years, like they usually have current event units like that, but no, for me it was more just like learning about the like what government is, like the different branches, and it's a lot of it's really historical, I would say. Like I learned obviously like through my education a lot about Abraham Lincoln and like that kind of thing, but not so much about like even like the Bush administration when I had like gone to school, or the Obama or Clinton, or like all these things that keep like coming up and are really relevant to today's politics were kind of like brushed over at best, I would say.
But Joan, I'm going to switch this over to you, because what, after you you know, kind of coached Serena through this co-hosting process with youth voting, what did you learn from this situation that Serena's talking about with the lack of education?
Well, Serena wrote a really excellent blog about her conversation, and the agreement that they found in this conversation that high school didn't prepare them to vote, I took as a really important signal. And John Gable, who has become a friend through the Bridge Alliance and has an organization called All Sides. And I found ourselves talking about this. All Sides is a website and service that provides news from left, right, and center, side by side on the same topic. So you get to see how very differently media with a different orientation covers the exact same event. It really clarifies why we sometimes find ourselves living in very separate narratives and not understanding each other. And John and I both thought that, wow, we really need to have something going on in schools that allows kids to feel very ready to vote. In fact, since we are paying for education for 12 years for kids or 13 years for kids, so that we have an educated electorate, it strikes me that 18 to 24-year-olds should be the most likely to vote, where the data in California is that in 2014, under 10% of 18 to 24-year-olds voted. Now, when voting is what causes people running for office to speak to specific groups, if people running for office don't think youth are going to vote, then they're not going to speak to their issues, and they don't all too frequently. And so you have a downward spiral of participation, because then the people that are coming into the system look at the elected leaders and the people that are trying to get elected and say, well, they're not talking about issues that I care about, and they do not find it important. So John and I talked about a civics and civility program. All Sides has been working on a critical thinking school curriculum, because just organically, teachers have been bringing the All Sides materials into the classroom. And layering onto the critical thinking, the basically civility, respect, emotional intelligence that underlies the structure of the living room conversation, so that we can have good conversations with each other and value our differences, is an incredibly powerful thing to do. And if we could see schools around the country giving all the students the capacity to really listen to each other and value different viewpoints and work collaboratively instead of adversarially, understand about confirmation bias, have some sophistication about how one might be able to hold the tension of differences, be able to have people with different opinions and yet still be able to hear each other and work together, I think it could be transformative, you know, not just at that early age range, but throughout the society.
So, John, I want to follow up on that, because you just did a perfect lead-in to talk about what happened last week when we actually got to try this out in a school. You want to kind of expound on what happened last week?
That was fun. We put together some materials. So this was our pilot project, and we were invited to try them out at a junior high school with three classes of eighth graders, the Julia Morgan School. And we have a single page that goes through fundamentally what are these characteristics that make it so that we don't hear each other when we come from a different viewpoint. You know, the confirmation, all those different characteristics. And then a living room conversation that's about relationship matters. You know, that's the title of it, relationship matters, so that the kids could talk about, you know, was there a time when they saw people not hearing each other because they came from different viewpoints? Have they found times when they were able to hold the tension of differences in order to have a relationship and conversation, even so, you know, the experiential part? And it was very exciting because we tried offering these materials in different ways, and in all cases, the kids just totally got into it, and it was a loud classroom in a good way as they were talking to each other about all these issues, and the teacher enjoyed the process too and appreciated the simplicity of the approach. So I was just kind of thrilled that our first pilot worked so well and can't wait to try more.
Yeah, and I think it was interesting. I think one of the things you and I talked about before the radio show was also about how the teacher just kind of got it instantly and thought, oh my gosh, this is so easy to do. And so really, you know, kind of conveyed that to the class, like it's really easy to have these conversations. Was there anything more about that that you wanted to, like, throw in here?
What I find so valuable about understanding human dynamics that affect the way we work is that this is good for politics. This is also good for, you know, work relationships and just personal relationships. So these kids were at a school that I think is pretty sophisticated, and I want to try it in different schools. But when she said that the materials were simple and easy, I was just thrilled because that, I think, is what will allow that to fly in other places.
This is just a note to teachers out there who might be listening that livingroomconversations.org will have these materials up on the website. So go there and we'll put them on the homepage so they're easy to find. Serena, I want to pass it back to you for just a second because even though your initial kind of like outcome for youth voting didn't get your other friends to go register to vote, there's some other pretty cool things that happened for you. You know, you wrote the blog. And what happened after that?
Oh, I won an award for the blog, maybe is what you're referring to.
Right.
For the East Bay Youth Media Awards. And I would say more than anything, it just opened up my ability to, like, talk to other people about Living Room Conversations. So, yeah.
Yeah, not only did you win an award, but I think you also got to appear on a morning TV show to talk about it a little bit.
On the news. It was great.
Yeah, so I just thought that was so cool because, I mean, one of the things that we talk about with Living Room Conversations is that the conversation isn't the end point, it's really just the beginning. And so we have this kind of arc right now of Serena, you had a, you know, didn't feel prepared for talking at, you know, for voting and how to find out information about issues, and you talked to Joan. Then you co-hosted a Living Room Conversation, and out of that Living Room Conversation, you know, you feel more comfortable in speaking to others. Joan saw the need for something in schools and started developing this whole other program. And, you know, every Living Room Conversation that we've done has been like that. Like, there are unknown outcomes that come forth just as the result of having a Living Room Conversation. And Joan, I don't know if you want to pick it up from there and talk about something else.
Take it to, there's also a college program that works on voter registration where I'm talking to the leader of that and offering the Living Room Conversation as a tool to have kids that do and don't expect to vote have this conversation. And then I am hoping that with the culture behind it that's supporting, because when you go back into your normal day-to-day life and there's nothing to support, it's really almost the most common and predictable thing that people will revert to what they've been doing in their belief system they have. But if you have a change in dynamics where there's a group of people that are starting to say, yeah, let's make this a priority, I'm hoping that that can happen on campuses around the country. And you know, because that's a place where there's concentration of youth, that's a place where I would like to see far more than 10%. 90% voting participation. That would be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And the leadership will focus on the youth vote, and we need that.
Yeah, exactly. It's so funny because just in sharing a quick personal story, I turned 18, and it was either on my birthday or like the next day, I was at the county clerk's office registering to vote. Because in my personal family dynamic, voting was your citizen obligation. You just did it. No questions. That's what happened. But I look back now, and it's kind of like my family didn't do anything else. There was no issue development or discussion around the table. It was really, kind of a void, Serena, back to what you were talking about. It's like I knew I had to vote, but I had what I was prepped with in school, and heaven forbid I actually read a newspaper because that was what old people did. But that minimal kind of citizen obligation kind of carried me through because I've voted in every election since then. And it's interesting to note that how disenfranchised people feel that voting is even important. It just blows me away because I grew up, this is the tension of our differences. I grew up with such a different perspective that it's like I had to vote. That's what I was supposed to do. And then to end up as a political advocate in later life is kind of funny to me because that was definitely not my background growing up. So, Jill, I want to switch over here. And Serena, I think I'm going to switch away from youth voting right now. So if you had something else to go do, since it's, you mentioned earlier, it's your first day back at school today, I just want to thank you for being on the show, and I'm going to just sit here and have a conversation with Joan, I think.
Debbie Lynn, I'm going to jump in here real quick before we let Serena go and she runs away, because I have a couple questions for Serena, Joan, and you. The first question I have is, Living Room Conversations is a very amazing and unique process, but it's not a new concept in our life. Why do you think it is so difficult in today's society to actually sit down and have an open and honest conversation with people?
I'm going to suggest that Joan go first.
Okay. I believe one of the reasons it's so difficult to have a conversation with people now is people expect disrespectful responses if they talk about topics that they disagree on, because that's what's been modeled in the media too much, and even by leadership. So the concept of talking to each other in a really thoughtful, interested fashion isn't the first thing that comes to mind for people. I have friends that have said, oh, yeah, I'm going to do this. And then when they start thinking about it, they go, but what if it didn't go well? I wouldn't want it to not go well with my neighbor. If you don't want it to go badly with your neighbor, you sure as heck don't want to go badly with someone that's a business colleague or someone in your church or whatever the relationship, and all of a sudden you're not doing it because you're fearful that it will hurt your relationship. I've, been in groups that were interested and gone around and said, why did you come? And everybody in the group has mentioned the loss or diminished relationships because of politics. And that's really sad because, rather than deepening our connection, we're using politics as something where we judge each other and then we distance ourselves. That, I believe, is the primary problem we have right now.
Thanks, Joan. Serena, you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. I think that as far as it goes for people my age, I think that everyone is so involved right now in their own lives and school and different majors and extracurricular activities. I've been looking at my friends' schedules and seeing that no one really has time. So I think that a huge part about that for us is that it's not something that necessarily is focused on in school or at our schools. And if it's not focused on there, then I don't, a lot of people aren't necessarily going to want to sit down and have a political discussion once you get out of class. And then also I think that a lot of these conversations are kind of just on, like, if you are interested in it, you might turn to, like, the internet or to, like, social media, some kind of thing to, like, look for your information there. And then it's so easy to just kind of get, like, narrowed into your own kind of viewpoint. And, like, if I want to learn about the presidential candidates, like, I'm going to, like, probably just, like, narrow into, like, Bernie Sanders or, like, whoever I see as, like, a candidate that I want, and then, like, not really so much, like, learn about other people's viewpoints. Like, I'm not going to actively seek out people who disagree with me. So I think one of the things that Living Room Conversations does that's, like, good and different is, like, I did have to, like, sit down and talk to not just my friends, but my brother's friends who have come from way different places than me or my friends and grew up, like, in different ways. So I think it's just, like, a good structure to be able to actually, like, seek out alternative points of view.
My second question comes from an observation that Sharina made earlier on in this conversation, where when she sat down with the group of her friends, they seemed to be excited and ready to have the conversation about youth voting. But yet when she followed up with them a few weeks later, their attitude had changed, almost like they couldn't really do anything about it, so why bother? Now, this is an attitude that our society as a whole has, where we seem to band together relatively quickly when we see an injustice or a tragedy happen. But as time passes, we seem to go back to the everyday life of nothing really matters because it's not affecting me. The question that comes to mind, for me at least, is why do we seem to have this attitude? And the second part of that question is there anything we can do to actually change that attitude?
Serena, you want to take that one first this time?
Okay. I think that in this experience, or in that experience of that conversation, the reason that that happened was just that, like, it was specifically, like, my brother and his friends really, like, they don't involve themselves in politics, and, like, the people that they surround themselves with just, like, aren't constantly, like, keeping that in mind, I guess. And so when they, after, like, a couple weeks of, like, not really thinking about it, I think that they just kind of went back to, like, their old ideas, like what Joan was saying, where people will just kind of, like, go back to what they naturally, like, think if they're not being asked to think in a different way. Yeah, that's just exactly what happened. And during the conversation, I think that they were just kind of inspired because we did find that, like, the things that we cared about were all the same. And I think in the conversation, especially, one of the biggest things that we talked about was that voting doesn't mean that you're so involved in politics even. It's just, like, the smallest thing that you can do is just, like, take a couple minutes out of your day to, like, go vote. But yeah, in the end, I guess it didn't, like, convince them when they weren't, like, constantly being asked to think about it.
I think that's just part of real life too, that, you know, change requires a lot of effort, and
yeah,
changing our minds has the added risk of losing our friends. Loki, I'm going to answer your previous question right now because I have a story I want to share, and then we'll move on to John. When I had what I kind of call my political awakening, I moved from being in advertising and marketing to being involved with politics. And over the course, you know, and that included a run for office and getting involved with a couple of political organizations. And over the course of the next 2 years, all of my friends, I don't mean some of my friends, I mean all of my friends changed. And it was a real eye-opener to me about how much our common interests tie us together. And I do still stay in touch, of course, with some of my friends before that. But it's one of those kind of unspoken things where we don't talk politics, you know, even to the extent one of my family members, we don't talk politics because that's just one of the forbidden topics in case we might have a disagreement.
And so, Joan, when you were talking about the impact on personal lives, it's a very real impact for me to know that people who I deeply care about and am friends with want to be cut off from, 80% of my life because they're afraid. I've walked through that fear, but they are afraid. And I'm not sure, I think Living Room Conversations is one opportunity to help people walk through that fear. I'm going to go back to you, John, now.
Yeah, I think change is something that is humans are naturally challenged by, and that when we do make change, and the reason I think Living Room Conversations are powerful is they cause our hearts to change because we develop relationships with people we otherwise would not. That's when change really happens. And so creating that opportunity for personal connection can be extremely powerful. And there's, but we are communal creatures. And if our community does not support the change we're attempting to make, the likelihood is that we will either quickly or gradually shift back to where we were, because it's extremely uncomfortable to be out of step with the people you're close to. But I think creating the space for differences and the appreciation for differences can be incredibly powerful and freeing and good for all of us. And Living Room Conversations are one tool, but it's got to be something that is bigger than that one tool. It's got to allow more things to happen, open up other doors.
Thank you, Joan. That's an awesome way to put it. Serena, I want to just thank you for being with us today. I know you need to run off and get to class today on your first day back at school. So namaste to you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Serena.
Have a good day.
All right, bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break here. And when we come back, Joan and I will continue our conversation about other topics that Living Room Conversations covers.
Listen to Living Room Conversations, where we put the personal back into interpersonal communications, here on the Coffee Party USA Radio Network.
Okay, back to the three of us. So, Loki, thank you for those very thoughtful questions.
And are there any more questions you would like to do?
I just sit back and listen to the conversation, and my brain gets to going. So I'm sure before the end of the conversation, there will be more.
Joan, in regards to the last thing that you talked about, too, I do have, there's a couple of friends that I have from, before I went political, so to speak, who like I said, I stay in contact with them. But most of the contact, if it is about politics, it's them kind of like trying to needle me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they're like mimicking the behavior of the media, but they always kind of like come at me full on with some question that feels like a setup, that if I answer it in any way other than what they believe to be true, I would appear foolish in their eyes. And it's real interesting on how I just don't, I don't operate that way anymore. Living Room Conversations has kind of helped build those skills up, where I want to have the meaningful conversation and not the gotcha question, so to speak. But it's also a way, because we have some longevity, I can call them out on it, and there's some camaraderie around it. So it's almost like this expected sparring,
mm-hmm.
which is, as long as we both find it fun, it's okay. But there's a lot of people who don't like that type of sparring. And I was sharing with the Coffee Party radio team the other day something that one of our Living Room Conversations colleagues had brought up, and that was the kind of like the personality styles of the volatile and the validator and the avoider. as the way people kind of approach relationships and conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And we were having a great time talking about it amongst the radio team. And really looking forward to having a deeper conversation about, you know, how can we relate to each other when we're not matched up with a similar communication style. And I know that I've had to, especially when I'm dealing with volatile, with people who have like a very, and that volatile is not a bad thing. It's just somebody who's very emotive and very passionate, and then they may express themselves loudly. And I know I have to step up my game to respond in a way that they can hear me. And it's been a really interesting experiment over the last month or so. I look forward to diving into that deeper. And wondering
that's
how living in
interesting way to look at things. I think for folks to, and I don't look at it that way because I see, I experience the conversations as I have as very individually, but there is some real value in breaking it down in some context, because there are people that communicate very differently.
I think one of the things I'm having fun with this one, Joan, is that, you know, I try on different models, you know, so it's kind of like I'm going to look at the world through this lens for a little while, through this model of communication, to see what I can learn. And it's not like, it's not the way the world is, so to speak, but it's really like, oh, that's interesting. I want to try on this perspective for a while. And I think living room conversations helps us do that too. In that we have living room conversations allows us to hear these multiple perspectives in a single setting and try something different on, even if it's just for the 2 hours of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it invites everyone to be not volatile for a couple hours. So there's a little volatility in it. I've got, definitely there are very lively conversations, but it's got a cap that makes us non-volatile feel like it's a good conversation even so.
Yeah, I think one of the things I'm learning with trying just this particular model on for a little while is that that I'm actually not in danger when I'm with a volatile personality. And I say volatile, right? Maybe we should just say passionate. So somebody who's very expressive and loud and insistent, because to, you know, for trying on that persona for just a little while, mm-hmm. there's a certainty that provides comfort. And where I like living in the question, other people like living with certainty and are willing to defend it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been really interesting because I'm now less afraid and more willing to be in relationship with people who are very passionate because I feel like I understand it a little better.
And passion is fun.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. So I want to go back, Joan, and talk a little bit about, we've kind of gone into through the youth voting and kind of what one conversation on youth voting has led to in the world. And I want to go back and talk about some of the other conversations that we've kind of guided along and what's happened as a result of those conversations. Do you have a favorite one that you want to talk about now?
Well, I think the conversation that has had the most impact that I've been part of was the conversation I co-hosted with Mark Meckler of Tea Party Patriots. That conversation with Mark and his friends and me with my friends led me to understand that there is a level of agreement about criminal justice reform that I had no understanding of until that point, and has allowed living room conversations and me in specific to participate in this, you know, growing movement of left and right together to make our criminal justice system more just, dramatically better. When you have a consensus that we've got too many people in prison and the war on drugs is not working, and that evidence-based practices need to be employed, there's a much better chance of us actually doing it. Now, the interesting thing about this is, have the political space to make change now. There's still a huge amount of change that needs to actually happen. So it's this opening that is incredibly significant. But taking that step, it's that issue we've been talking about. Change is hard to do. And to change actual practices is going to take some real focus and intentionality, changing systems and incentives so that we have fewer people in prison. There have been some good legislations that have helped a little, but there's a whole lot more that needs to happen in the coming years.
Can you make a little connection for us between how your conversation with Mark Meckler ended up in the real world? Like, what happened next?
Yeah. After the conversation we had, Mark and I both together and separately found ourselves talking about criminal justice reform and the fact that there is a great deal of agreement on the left and the right that we need to make dramatic changes in the system. And that had ultimately led to a event in Washington, D.C. You know, on my side, we helped convene an event in Washington, D.C. of leaders on the left and right that was the seed for the Coalition for Public Safety, which is an organization that is funded by the Koch brothers and Ford and MacArthur and the Arnold, which is amazing and has really large players from the left and the right working on some of these issues, because there are opportunities where there's just about 100% agreement that we need to be making change. And, so they're hopefully going to be helping the really high agreement opportunities happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a lot more from there, because the things, there's a lot of complexity to this, too. You know, right now, prosecutors are rewarded for putting people into prison. Well, as we get clearer and clearer that prison is not the best place to send people and is only right for a subset, actually a small subset of people, maybe it would be better if they were rewarded for making their communities safer over the long term, because you know, when you send someone to prison for a year or two, that's likely to make it very hard for them to earn a living going forward and much more likely to end up back in prison. So what is the best outcome for the community and the people that are getting put into the criminal justice system? How do we make this a system that's actually making our communities safer? And that's a very complex problem that's going to take some real thoughtful and collaborative work.
Well, I think the other thing that's interesting about this, Joan, is because it's not something that just happens at the policy level, but it really does happen at local levels and in neighborhood levels. As people get more and more coalesced, I think might be the word I'm looking for, around the idea that jail or prison isn't the right answer for all crime. And the attitudes, the hearts of the people in our communities need to change. And I think we know that Living Room Conversations has helped in that way, helped change some hearts from the project we did in the Central Valley, which was something else that happened after your conversation with Mark. It's part of the path on criminal justice reform. But I want to make sure that people feel like connected to this issue, because if they wanted to have their own Living Room Conversations, it's not like they're necessarily going to go out and start, participate in a national movement. But But by having that conversation in their own communities, in their own homes, what do you think is possible for people kind of at the grassroots level?
I think we're learning that. I think it starts with connection with each other and finding out what people are most motivated by. And then, you know, at the end of the conversation, the question is there anything you would like to do next based upon this conversation? And that may be something that's come up that's a place where there's common ground, or it may be a next conversation. But each community is so unique. That's why there's the need to really sit down and talk together in a way that allows people to start to build the relationships that allows for coming up with the solutions that meet everybody's key needs. In the area of criminal justice reform, I think the vast majority of people that are sent to prison come back to the community they came from. And right now, what happens in way too many communities is people are released, given almost nothing to survive on, and return to a community with way less than almost anybody that didn't have a record path would need to, you know, set themselves up and get started. So it just kind of sets people up for failure. Well, there are some communities that have looked at this and they've gone, wow, we'd do a whole lot better if we created jobs, places to be, halfway houses, support systems for people re-entering our community. And that's been very, very successful.
Just as you're speaking about that, Joan, I'm reminded of a TED Talk I was just watching again last night, and it was talking about how everything we know about addiction is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because for anybody who's looked into criminal justice reform at all knows that our jails are filled with both addicts and people who have mental illness, and sometimes both, often both. And he was sharing, Johan gets the last name wrong, was talking about how Portugal did an experiment 15 years ago where they legalized all drugs and took the same amount of money that they used to spend in criminal justice reform and put that into treatment and job creation and housing and stuff, so instead of having a punitive approach, we ended up with a support and connection approach. Because his basis for doing that was that people who are, let me back up just half a sec. There was an experiment that was done with rats where if you put a rat in a cage by itself with a water bottle that has plain water in it and a water bottle that has narcotics in it, the rat will kill himself on the narcotics. So then the same scientist built a bigger cage and put many rats in there with lots of things to do, lots of, you know, friendly rats, and same two water bottles, one plain, one with narcotics. And the rats almost never drank out of a narcotic water bottle. And if they did, it was never to excess or compulsively. And so he kind of turned that over and said, okay, humans are not rats, but what if it's about the connection in the environment that creates the pain so that the narcotic is the only thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
And base that, and on that basis, you know, Portugal put in this different system of, like, how do we help people with addiction and treat it as a health issue instead of as a criminal issue? And I know that our work together with Living Room Conversations on Criminal Justice Reform has only confirmed that, talking about confirmation bias, has confirmed that belief in me that we need a different plan. And it's just one area that Living Room Conversations has touched on, though. I mean, we've also talked recently about a supply-side solution to climate change, or to clean energy, excuse me. It was a supply-side solution to clean energy.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been things on gay marriage and religious freedom. What are some of the bigger topics? Oh, and there was a big one just a couple weeks ago in Connecticut. You want to talk about that for a minute?
That's right. We had a guns and responsibility conversation in Newtown, Connecticut. And Rabbi Shaul Braver and the Reverend Robert Schenck, who's a conservative evangelical minister co-hosted this conversation where they had a diverse group talking about their relationship with guns and just the moral position on what the relationship should be with guns. Because guns are one of these wedge issues where we have been trained to just go to the fight. And this is a really beautiful conversation about what people's personal experience and relationship to guns was. So that they were able to find their shared ground, because everybody wants their communities to be safe, and they want their loved ones to come home in the evening, and everyone else's too. So there's this disconnect between this deep shared value and the fight in politics, and they didn't go to the fight. They went to the shared background and also to better understand their differences. Because I think it's once we understand our differences and how we might be able to satisfy each other's basic core values that I think we'll find some solutions.
Thanks, Joan. The fact that happened in Newtown, Connecticut to me also is just very poignant. And I'm so grateful that we have some partners there who had that conversation. I think I'm out of questions, Loki. How about you have some that have popped up?
I do, actually. A lot of the topics we have discussed today have been centered around politics or even topics that some would consider to be taboo to even discuss. Now, for us as activists, it's no big deal. That's what we do, bringing up the things that nobody else wants to talk about. But for somebody new to the living room conversation process and concept, is there any topic out there that they could use as an icebreaker where they may feel safer or less intimidated?
I think anyone can have the relationship matters conversation. We have it designed for schools right now, but I think that's a good conversation for someone that wants to have an introductory conversation where there is not a conflict piece to it at all. The other one I thought was really productive and interesting was the conversations about where and how we talk politics. When Eric Vog had that conversation with his friends, it was fascinating to hear this group that really wanted to talk politics discover that they didn't clearly see a place where we could do that in a constructive way, that once we label each other, we tend to dismiss each other. And I'm still thinking about that conversation myself. So it's not a conversation that ends up in differences so much as self-exploration with friends.
I think that was a really good way to put that, Joan, because part of what Eric Fogg, talking politics with his friends, talking politics is a topic title. What I took away from that was kind of like this self-awareness, the self-revelation of when are times that I shut down the conversation around politics because it's not what I want to hear. I was talking about sparring with some of my friends earlier, and we have a relationship where that's possible, but if it's somebody that I don't know well and they tried to spar with me, I would shut them down in a heartbeat because that feels unsafe to me. And so that self-awareness so that I can be more open and maybe do a turn on that, open sparring comment so that we can actually have a good conversation. That's kind of where I ended up with that one. So talking politics is an awesome subject for people who are just starting out, because you're not talking about any specific issues. The relationships matters is another awesome topic for that. We also have one about the American dream. That's another just kind of like, what does it mean? What is it for you? And then we have some that are a little bit, entertainment, media,
that might be a little lighter, just kind of talking about what do you learn from the media and doing some self-reflection on that, running through. I think the rest of them are more political issues that are, that the other political issues, some of them are more or less controversial. So it depends on your group of friends, I think, honestly, it would be scary or not to have. So the living room conversation, to set one up, there's five easy steps to do. The first thing to do is to pick your co-host and a date. So get together with a friend of yours who's different than you are in some way, so you have a little bit of diversity. Then select a topic, and we have a list of topics at livingroomconversations.org. You can also create your own topic. There's a generic set of materials there that you can use. And then invite your friends. Each co-host invites two more friends, so you get six people total. On the date of your conversation, you actually have the conversation. And then the last thing that we ask, which is really, really, really important, is to provide us with feedback. There's a feedback form and the materials, and getting those back to us just really helps us grow and make the Living Room Conversations process better. And if you really want to get out there, you could write a blog about it like Serena did, and kind of take that learning, share that learning with others. So those are the five easy steps. In the conversation, one of the things that makes a living room conversation so special is that as part of the conversation, you actually read and review these six ground rules. And these are all things, John, I'm going to quote you here, these are all things we learned in kindergarten, but somewhere along the lines, we don't necessarily follow them all the time. So here they are. Here's the six. Number one, be curious and open to learning. Number two, show respect and suspend judgment. Number three, look for common ground. Number four, be authentic and welcome that from others. Number five, be purposeful and to the point. And number six, own and guide the conversation. So basically, it's like listen deeply, don't listen so you're planning what you're going to say next. Respect other people's opinions. It's based on their experience. Look for what you have in common. Share what's really important to you. That this one is like the biggest one to help people connect because we're actually sharing real important things with each other. Notice if you're on your soapbox or somebody else is on your soapbox, is on their soapbox, and kind of bring it back to the conversation at hand. And then, make sure that the conversation is being impactful for everyone. So if you own and guide the conversation, everybody takes a part in that. So there's the six ground rules and the five easy steps to have your own living room conversation.
Just for me, when I sit down to have any conversation with anybody, whether it's following the living room conversation guidelines, which makes having a conversation so much easier, or just having a day-to-day conversation, the one thing that I have to realize, right now our society, our nation, is being divided. We're being divided because of faulty beliefs, fears, and we create these labels amongst ourselves, even with in our own lives. We have our labels and the stereotypes. When you want to sit down and have a healthy relationship and really learn and start to make changes in your own life or in what our nation needs, those political changes, you have to be willing to walk into that conversation and set those labels aside and see each other as friends, as neighbors, as family members, but most importantly, see them as human beings that have their own belief systems, that have feelings, and their own choices.
I love your statement. I was making sure it wasn't a soapbox. Well, that's it for Living Room Conversations today via Coffee Party Radio. I want to thank Joan Blaze, our guest from Living Room Conversations, and Serena Witherspoon, who's a student at Berklee Community College and has co-hosted a Living Room Conversation. A big thank you also to my co-host and producer, Loki King. And we're signing off till next week. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you for listening. This has been Living Room Conversations, courtesy of Coffee Party USA Radio. You can learn more at coffeepartyusa.com and make sure to click on that big red button that says Become a Member. Coffee Party USA is 100% volunteer and member supported. That's you. So thanks for listening. Make it a great day.